David, would you like to tell me how you first came to be in Malden?
Well, my parents got married after my father left the Navy after the war, after the Second World War. He went to... he was 20 by that time, I think. He joined up when he was 17, served in the Pacific, and was at... Not at D-Day. He was on a small craft, kind of minesweeper type thing, who went into the Normandy beaches somewhere. I don't know. At on June the 5th, the day before, the night before, and sent a. He was a radio operator, and they sent him into the beach with a. Captain or something who was then on reconnaissance went inland, and they were both supposed to be picked up before dawn. The captain didn't come back, so my father was picked up and taken back to the ship on the morning of the 6th, and then they got out. Anyway, so after the war, my father went to one of those training colleges that were set up for ex-servicemen who were coming out in droves, and so he became he qualified as a PE teacher, and then he married my mother. She was Protestant, he was Catholic, caused a big furore in the family, so they decided to get out of Liverpool. This was so he applied to several education committees, and Essex Education Committee came back with an offer. So it was purely a stroke of luck. He was told to report to Malden Secondary School, and he came up the hill from the train station. First thing he got to was St. Peter's graveyard. Noticed that everybody in there was had died either at 80 or older. So he thought, this is the place. So he started at Malden Secondary School in 1949, probably, with some other ex-servicemen on the staff. Charlie Tate was one of them. Who was teaching art. They were all, quite a lot of them were ex-services. Winnie Keeble was there, who was married to Hobby Keeble in Victoria Road, who was the barge skipper, and was skipper on the Dawn most of his working life, I think. Hobby Keeble. And me and my mother came down from Liverpool in 1950. So I was one when I came to Malden. And I grew up here, went to school at Malden County Primary School. I think I went to All Saints Sunday School at one point. But most of the time, if I went to Sunday school, which was a formative thing that everybody did then, all the kids did, it was at the Methodist. For some reason, everybody went to the Methodist. Anyway, so our first flat was opposite All Saints in the High Street. And we were there for about 2 or 3 years, I think. The downstairs was an office. And it was owned by the South End Standard newspaper. And the young chap running that Malden office was a guy called John Savage. And he did all the Malden news in the South End Standard. And my father noticed that upstairs was empty. So he went into the South End Standard office and introduced himself to John Savage, who must have been about 20 himself then, about in a similar age. And it it worked out that if my father, being a PE teacher, would do all the reports of Malden Town Football Club, their matches down at Famridge Road, then he could have the flat upstairs for a peppercorn rent or something like that. So we ended up living in this flat opposite All Saints. It's not above, can't remember the name of the shop that it is now. It's a kind of market research place. But it's next door to Templeman's and like there.
And yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I sort of... And the first thing I remember, my earliest memory ever, is being wheeled up the high street in a pram by my mother. I must have been about 3. And knowing that I wasn't going to be in that pram much longer, I was going to have to walk. So it was wonderful time. When I started school at Malden County Primary School, my mother used to walk me down there. I started in September of 1955. And that summer, my mother used to take me down to the Baby's End at the end, on the lake. And I used to paddle around in there and in the sand. And there was loads of screaming kids there. Just a normal situation. And my father would sometimes join us after school finished. That was the routine that summer. I remember that. Anyway, so I went to Malden County Primary School into the class, beginner's class, of a young lady called Ruby Cole. She was the teacher. She was in her 20s, obviously. And that was fine. And our first reading book was Dick and Dora. It was a kind of two-colour, red and black book. And I got through that pretty quick, I think, because in the October of 1955, we moved out of the flat and into the council estate that was being built along Munden Road, between Munden Road and Park Drive. It was called the Primrose Mead Estate. And we moved into Primrose Walk, which was the first set of houses to be completed. Primrose Walk was, and the actual things houses going along Park Drive. They were breeze block. They were built of breeze block. Fantastic houses they were. I remember seeing the tar going down on the floors because we visited before we moved in. And we moved in on my 5th birthday, which was in October. And there we stayed. My mum and dad were there for 47 years. Wonderful. Bought the place in the end, of course. But this was part of the building programme, the housing estate, the social housing that came after the war. I don't know whether it was the Labour government that started it, I think. Anyway, there was money for the local authorities to build social housing, council housing. And we moved in October 55, and pretty much the whole of Primrose Walk from Meadway down to the ditch at the bottom was all filled up, was inhabited. In that October, they came from, a lot of people came from Heybridge, Causeway, my next door neighbours who had a son 1 year younger than me, perfect, and a few others. And next door, they came from the Towers, Bentall's old Towers, in Colchester Road, whatever.
So pretty local. They weren't from London.
Oh no, no. The council housed everybody that had a problem, you know, or they were going to knock down the towers anyway. I suppose I never actually saw the towers up, except for the gate. So we had. It was an idyllic childhood. We were 100 yards basically from the prom. Spent the life on the prom. We used to play football on a Saturday morning. on what was called Top Green, which is now the Blackwater Leisure Centre, whatever. They have tennis courts and they have, I think, squash courts, that kind of, that place. That was just a rough ground, and it was built, it was like it was soil that had been dumped there from whatever situation there, but it grassed over. It grassed over by the time I got there. And I don't know whether there were goalposts or whether it was just, you know, coats. But we used to play every Saturday morning, all from the estate. When I first arrived there, Primrose Walk, between Primrose Walk and Park Drive, it was all red clay. It had been all ploughed up ready for building. And the first thing they did was to put in the curbstones. So you had these gleaming white curbstones all the way between Primrose Walk and Park Drive. And it was all red clay apart from the curbstones. So you knew where the roads were going. And all that. They were filled in over the next year or so. But for the first year, at least for the first year, we had a wonderful experience of having this building site. And all the kids used to run up the scaffolding of when they were building the old age bungalows. And we watched them paint as the buildings went up. This wonderful smell, a smell of paint then. It was proper lead paint. It was a beautiful smell. And there was lots of mounds of sand to play in, and there was bricks to build prisons with, which we did an awful lot. And it was... then after that was finished, when they finished building the houses and more families came in, more kids came in, we all got on fine, and we all went down the prom. So by the time I was six or seven, probably, I was allowed to go down the prom. And with the other kids, we were allowed to go swimming in the lake. So we grew up in various stages around the lake. We started off on the opposite the riverside. Then it got too crowded with little kids because we were getting bigger. So we went across to the Bath Wall side, and then we eventually got to the changing huts and all of that, and the diving boards. And anyway, it was blissful up to whatever. I was a teenager before I stopped going swimming particularly. Probably mid-teenage, I should think. By which time I'd left the primary school and went to the grammar school. So I started at the grammar school in 1962, September. And it didn't make an auspicious start, I must say. I was still kind of mucking about a bit. Not naughtily, but just interested in other things other than, you know, French or even English. I came 27th out of a class of 31 in English. It's all a question of luck who you get to teach you, because this woman, and I can't remember her name, but she was teaching for two terms. She was teaching us clause analysis. And it had nothing to do with English, as far as I could see, you know. Well, it did, but... in my second year, I remember being able to bring home a report to my mother and father. And English, I was then fourth in the class, because the teacher was... Miss McKinley taught me English in the second year. And she sort of... was lent more towards the creative side, you know. If you wrote essays, then all well and good, you know. So anyway, I was always a decent speller and all that kind of thing, but clause analysis, no. So I probably couldn't tell you a subject and predicate now, you know. Wouldn't be able to do it. written books, but sometimes teachers and pupils just do not mix. I had a wonderful time in grammar school. Fantastic.
That's what surprised me when you said about English and you weren't good at it, because I know you have written several books.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway, so not that I knew I was going to do that then. What I thought I was going to do when I was at grammar school, I kind of I found the work okay. Some of it was quite interesting. Others, parts of it, were not. I was more caught up in games that I made up and that sort of thing. I used to have a football game at home. And this kind of expanded. So not just that I played a football game, but I wrote newspaper reports on the football game. And I developed this whole... Eventually, I developed this. This football had to be situated somewhere. So I designed this city, a small city. And so the city had to have cultural things going on. You know, so whatever I was listening to music-wise was what was going on in the city at that time. And also, to go back slightly... 1963, my father had left Malden Secondary School, and he'd gone to he applied and got head of PE at Sandon School under the headmaster Arthur Harvey, who was a very progressive literate man. He got a good crew together there. And I won't go on about my father too much, because there's all kinds of things. Like, he used to go on the Brighton vintage car rally with a couple of the teachers from the secondary school who were into cars, you know. I met one of my father's old pupils, who are now in their 80s, I think, or late 70s anyway. And he said that Roy Gilbert, who was one of the teachers there, who used to make these or restore these vintage cars. He had one in the centre court of the school, and all the kids used to help him at various times in their metalwork lessons or whatever. So he used to do that. But then he went to Sandon, and then from there he applied to do, because he'd done stuff with the school. He applied to do Outward Bound for Essex County Council, and he was doing that at the time, 1963. And he said, there's a barge race starting. He said, they haven't had it since the 30s or something. And he told me the names of some of the barges, some of the skippers, including Hobby Keeble, who was still out and about. So he said, shall we go down and have a look? So I said, yeah, okay. Sounds interesting to me. And because I'd come from this kind of nautical background, you know, my uncle, my father's brother, was the chief purser of the older Dempster line in Liverpool. He used to go to from Liverpool to Accra, to Ghana, to Nigeria. He knew all the potentates, and because that's how everyone travelled in the 50s and early 60s. And so when we went to Liverpool, which is regularly during either the Christmas holidays or the Easter holidays, so I knew Liverpool quite well up to late 60s. So that kind of had a big influence on me. Maritime wise, certainly, I loved ships. And then suddenly here in was it July 1962? I think, was it 62? I think it was, yeah. My father took me down in the canoe he'd built in night classes at school. And we went out on the river and we watched the barges come back. And the finishing line in those days for the barge match was off the prom. So they would all sail up right to the prom before they started furling in the sails. And he said he told me that the one that was expected to win, the one that was the fastest in the fleet at that particular time, was the Memory, sailing barge Memory, built in Harwich, and by the Cann family. Canns were big barge builders in Essex. Anyway, so they all came up, and it was the most stunning thing I'd ever seen. Being on the waterline and seeing these beautiful black vessels coming in with the red, ochre red sails.
How many would there have been?
That first one, I can't remember now. Certainly a dozen. First to come in was the Marjorie, which wasn't considered a particularly fast barge, owned by Pipe. Anyway. Followed by... could have been the Solcock Bell. There are records of these things. Solcock Bell was the most beautiful thing you'd ever seen. White hull, black gunwale, beautiful. She had been built as a stacky barge. She was quite broad and low on the water. Beautiful transom, the most fantastic, graceful thing. And I learnt that summer. I sort of, my father got me a book, probably from Hobby Keeble, about history of building sailing barges and where they'd come from. So the Marjorie was from Harwich. The Memory came in third. She was built by the Cairns, I think, as well. She was built in Harwich. There was a whole load of those beautiful... They're all timber. There wasn't a steel barge in the race. Mm. They were all beautiful... beautiful things. And so after the race, he got me, my father knew I was interested in it, so he got me this book, probably off Hobby Keeble, and I learnt all about the barges. And oh, well, I say all about it, I didn't sail them, but the history, what they were used for, where they were built. And realised, amongst other things, that there was a modern barge builder, and that he had built the Selkirk Bell. This she was so beautiful. And there was another one, and I'm not sure whether she was in that 1962 race, but she was certainly in it within a couple of years, and that was the My Rosa, also built by Howard, also a stacky barge. Also with the most beautiful, graceful transom, beautiful lines all the way around. And I learned all about John Howard, and that he would get a stem post, the main front of the barge, the big stem post at the front, and if it had a knot in it, he'd chuck it out. He was not interested in profit. He was interested in the lines and the money. It's his downfall on several occasions. But John Howard became a bit of a hero, you know. So, barges were a big thing. A couple of years later, 1965, my father got to know John Kemp, who had bought, or who had, through a trust or something, had bought the Memory. And... the reason why the Marjorie won on 62 was because the wind came up at the end of the race up the river, so the ones at the back were blown, got the wind first and got some momentum and came through. The following year, 1963, was a normal windy day, and the Memory raced it. She ran right the way through. I was so into it. I still remember it all now. I mean, 1964, the May won it, another Harwich barge. It was owned by Tate & Lyle at that time. I knew who owned it. I mean, you know, I did. So I knew the whole biography of it. I didn't. Anyway, 1965. There was a chap who'd bought the Edith May, another Harwich barge. She had a grey hull with black gunnels, but otherwise was similar to the other Harwich barges. But Edith May, in 1965, there were four barge matches that summer. The Thames, the Medway, Ipswich and Maldon. And she won all of them. She was fast. But I can't remember who owned her. But he'd put her into the basin, which meant it was fresh water, there was no barnacles, and she came out with a smooth bottom into the river, won everything.
Right.
They put the Morrows in there as well. Anyway, that's barges for you, till quite a lot later. The prom in those days, this was when I was 15, 16. School was going well, at least athletically. I broke every school record for the 100 metres, well, it was 100 yards in those days, and 220 yards. And apparently I'm told by my old PE teacher that I still hold the record for the long jump at the Plume School, as it is now called. I've got this fantastic photograph given to me this year that I'd never seen before. It was published in the Chronicle or the Standard. I'd never seen it before. And it's me at the finishing line of the 220 yards in 1965, 66. And the rest of the field are like 50 yards behind me. And I've got my hands stretched out. I don't know why I did that. It's probably because I noticed there was a photographer there. And, so that was all for me. Yeah, I broke the record. Academically, I was just holding my own because, like I was going to say before, I decided at that point I was going to be an actor. That's what I was going to do. And there was a chap above me, in the year above me, Stuart Rayner, who lived in Acacia Drive. He was going to be an actor too. And anyway, so by the time I got to the sixth form, I'd done enough to get into the sixth form, and you know, without really trying, I got a sufficient O levels. We got commandeered to do the school play, which was an annual production in front of the parents and all of that, three performances. And fantastic, we had a lovely time doing that, really enjoyed it. We did Nikolai Gogol's The Government Inspector, and I played a landowner, and my friend Stuart played the main character, who was mistaken for a government inspector by the local worthy. His name was Hlestakov. And we had a fantastic time. We had a wonderful time. At that time, I was definitely going to... I didn't know I was going to do it, you know. Stuart went off and auditioned for the National Theatre, which I think he did play, National Youth Theatre. And he did play a few roles with them. I think I was so nervous that when I eventually went for an audition with the National Youth Theatre, they said, thank you very much. That's the last I heard of that. But I was criminally shy, you know. Outside, I mean, you know, you tend to blossom in school, you know, because everybody knows you. So you can say something and people relate that back to something you said before, find it funny. And I was going to be something like that. I was going to be an actor, but I wasn't quite ready for it yet. So, and this photograph of me running the 220 yards kind of sums up my day, because in the background is the whole grammar school as it was, without the steel and glass buildings that are now plonked in front of it. It was perfect. It was the perfect time. And that photograph, for me, epitomises what I was going to be. What was I going to do? I was a fit young man, an athlete, and I applied to go to Loughborough Colleges, which was the which was the Oxford Cambridge of PE. You know, it was the sports capital of the UK. And I got in. You know, all international athletes went to Loughborough College, you know. Rugby players. As it turned out, two of my year at Loughborough College were in the England team. I knew several England internationals in the England rugby team. One was captain, the other one, and they won the Grand Slam. The Five Nations, as it was then. And went on, after they finished playing, I'll digress for a minute. After they finished playing, their names were Steve Smith, who was captain of England, and Cotton, Fran Cotton, who was in the scrum somewhere. After they left, I don't know however it came about, but they got the franchise to sell England rugby shirts. So they gave themselves the name, because Fran Cotton and Steve Smith, they gave themselves the name Cotton Traders. And are now in every service station you can find in the UK, probably. Anyway, that was something else. So where was I? Sixth form. Yeah.
Were you playing music at this
stage? No.
No?
No, I didn't play music. This is what that photograph was all about, you see, because I was an athlete. There I was with my arms displayed and off to Loughborough Colleges. And it was at Loughborough Colleges when I got into the second year at Loughborough Colleges. The first year that came in behind me was one young chap who played guitar. And he had a whole queue of girls, students, watching him play. And I was looking at this. And I had thought before that, you know, it would be really good if in one's life you got to learn to play an instrument, you know. But that was the moment. And I went up to him and I said, show me how to do that. Can you show me how to do that? He said, yeah. And he did. And I could play it. It was just a natural thing. It wasn't just strumming. It was a fingerstyle piece. And if you could play that, it looked like you could play a guitar. So he showed me how to play it. One Friday evening, he showed me how to play it. And I spent the whole weekend doing nothing but playing this piece. And on the Monday, I came in and played it to him, and I was in his band. From the Friday, instead of not being able to play, to the Saturday, to the Monday. And I was in the college band. And we did a few gigs as well. Some good, some not so good. But then I was playing. And suddenly I was listening to guitar players, amongst whom was Pentangle, who were an acoustic band that had played the Royal Festival Hall, done world tours. They did the music for a BBC series called Take Three Girls, which I was I really loved. Anyway, they were kind of beautiful classical. So I learned some of their songs and I learned a few other things. And I first of all played with the college band, and then after that I went, after the college I had a year off, went round Canada and did stuff like that. And busked in Marble Arch for about 6 months. And lived in a hotel, albeit a Paddington hotel, off the proceeds of busking. And then my father came up to see me busking one day. I said, you know, have you thought about what your career's going to be? And so I said, no, I haven't. I didn't know anyone in the music world, you know, particularly, apart from the other buskers. So he said, because there's a job coming up, teaching. And he knew that deputy head who he'd worked with. And it was a drama job, because I'd done my subsidiary course at Loughborough doing PE was drama, because obviously I was going to be an actor. I got put off acting because I didn't like working with other people. I'd much rather like working on my own, you know. So a cast full of lovies was not my idea of fun at all. So I put that idea on hold. And
where was the teaching job?
Sandon.
Oh.
Hmm. He knew I had contacts in Sandon. Anyway. So I thought if I get my probationary year done, then I'll have started, so that I'll go up the scales as it happens. So I took that job. I got offered that job. The headmaster, it was Ellis Williams. He said he'd been convinced by his deputy head's recommendation that I could get the job, because and I was busking in London. I was obviously the right kind of chap. But after I'd filled in my application form, he said he would have given it me anyway, whether it was friend of the friend or not. Anyway, so I did that. First year was great. Got a promotion at the end of the first year. Second year was great. We had a wonderful time. Third year, I should not have stayed, because at that point, I was getting quite good at playing guitar and playing all night. We were living in a flat above in the high street, up all stores. And that was up Sick Boots, which is now Santander, I think. Anyway, upstairs, it was a brilliant flat. Tall ceilings, big wide windows at the front anyway. We put up a poster at Christmas time saying Happy Christmas Boots on it. And they sent us a card and something, I can't remember.
Was this you and your parents, or were you with other young people at that stage?
Oh, no, my parents stayed in Primrose Walk. No, this is me and one teacher from the Plume and one friend of mine who came in to make it with three bedrooms, so we got three of us. The other guy worked for the Record Mirror. I commuted every day. Early 70s, so my collection of friends, drinking friends, were mostly teachers, or normal. That normal kind of situation. Anyway, third year I shouldn't have done it, because I was staying up all night playing guitar. And the kids used to do the register for me. That was really good of them. They were good kids, great kids. But I also began to tire of the staff room life. It was not for me, it wasn't. I wasn't cut out for it. Professionally or for a career, that wasn't what I was going to do. I had a great time with the kids, but no, it wasn't what I was going to do. So I was getting confident enough to go out and play in folk clubs at that point. This would have been 1976 by this time. And so I went out to a club in Hadley in Suffolk, and there was a duo playing there who were very impressive. One was a lead guitarist on acoustic guitar, and the other one was a fantastic singer, an American guy called Chris Jones, who had been an athlete in wherever he came from, Wisconsin, I think, I can't remember. But he'd been so good at basketball that he was signed by Real Madrid, who've got a big basketball team, big in Europe, big in Spain. So he'd just left Real Madrid at the end of his contract. He was 6'7" or something, and he came to England And he had a beautiful voice. Anyway, they were great. So I made myself known to them, and they said, "Well, you know, we're living in King's Cross, so come up, and you know, we'll sort of have a day out or something." So I did that, and within a few months, I'd moved in with the guitarist in Shepherd's Bush, and that was me in London. And so anyway, I came back from London, complete with two kids and their mother. She was actually she'd been living in Heybridge, met me at the Oakwood Arts Centre, which is off Whitehorse car park. It's now next to a gallery, Haylett's Gallery, or is Haylett's Gallery part of it? Anyway, so I met her there, and then within 6 months of meeting her, she'd moved up with to join me in Shepherd's Bush. We eventually had two children, and Shepherd's Bush was not the kind of place either of us thought was the right place for the kids. I mean, it might have been later, but at that time, we were in a flat, we didn't have any ground for them. So we decided we'd move out. We were in actually Kensington, done really okay that way. It was near a Shepherd's Bush, but it was postally Kensington. And we bought the flat we were in. So we decided to sell it. And after 15 years in London, I'd met everybody, I knew everybody, and I'd finally got my first sort of what you call a break. So the month we actually moved out of London, I went on tour for the first time with Pentangle, who the band I'd sort of been playing with. And anyway, that's another story. So initially we decided to move out in the suburbs a bit. And then one day, I was down in Maldon visiting my parents at Primrose Walk. And on the Sunday afternoon of that weekend, I went to, it was a lovely sunny day, and we were sitting outside at the Queen's Head on the quay. And it was such a lovely sociable occasion. Knew everybody that was coming in and out, you know. And anyway, come 6 o'clock or whenever it was, I drove back into London. Still a warm, sunny evening. And I drove down to Euston Road and then through. That's the way I went through to Shepherd's Bush. And the pavements were dusty and crowded. And I just sort of compared it to what I just left, which was a full Blackwater tide, you know, and the sun on it. And I thought, no, sod this. So we moved back to Maldon. We got a house in Maldon, in Victoria Road, and brought the kids up there. So I was on my way, kind of thing. I did this tour of Germany. I did another tour in the spring. I was on the road touring with one of the Pentangle guitarists, a big guitar hero in the UK called Bert Jansch. And I was touring with him for about 3 years. And I did the Edinburgh Festival, got a fantastic review at the Edinburgh Festival from the Scotsman. Four-star, five-star review? Anyway, brilliant. And recorded another album. This is all when we were in Victoria Road. I recorded a second album. And I'd really got my chops together, as they say, by that time. And it was an album of the year in Q magazine, which was national music magazine. And then I got Croppery Festival because I got in touch with Fairport Convention. You might have heard of them. Dave Pegg, who was the organiser of the festival, booked me. And then I did tours with the airport as well. Beautiful, big theatres, national tour. And I was doing okay. Radio 4, I was on Radio 4 and that kind of thing. So occasionally I did gigs in Maldon as well. I think the first one I did was at the Oakwood Centre. Or what would be the Haylett's Gallery now? It was down in the basement, was the first one I did. That was lovely. Then I did... I played solo gigs. I went out of Maldon for... I did one at the Crampon Theatre, but yeah, that was okay. In Maldon... I did, where did I play in Maldon? I think I played, before the Queen's Head turned the outbuilding into the restaurant, it was, I don't know what it was used for before, but anyway, it was cleared out and I did a gig in there with Jerry Conway from, on drums, from, he played with Jethro Tull and, Fairport and Pentangle. I did what was the Buick Suite.
Behind the Swan.
Behind the Swan. I played a few gigs in Maldon. I played at the Town Hall a couple of times. And then, of course, a bit later on, I mean, and I was playing all over UK and Denmark and Holland. I did it earlier, and Germany. So it was much later. My wife and I split up. The kids were about 14 and 13, and we couldn't afford the house, basically. So I went to live with a friend on a houseboat in Burnham and eventually took up residence on another houseboat next door to him on West Quay. Fantastic. Absolutely wonderful. It was a Rhine barge, you know, an old 120-foot Rhine barge. And the family that owned it lived in the main hold and they'd built superstructure. So they had two floors, looked like Hilton. It's fantastic. And the original quarters, which was the wheelhouse at the stern, and down below was a saloon, a galley, and two cabins with double bed in one of them. So I moved in there, and it was idyllic. I had, by that time, I was well into computers, and I had a computer in the wheelhouse. I built a desk in the wheelhouse, or a friend of mine did. I had a desktop computer. I had my guitar and the sun pouring through the windows and the doors open in the summer and the tide lapping up. You know, it's just idyllic. I had a wonderful time there. During that time, I had started in the millennium when I can't remember exactly how it came about, but I think the then town centre manager, can't remember her name now, asked me to write a song for the millennium for Maldon, which I did. But I also suggested to her that I write a play, a monologue, about Maldon and put it on. At the Millennium. So I got my friend Stuart, who, you know, the actor, to come down and play the part. And I wrote this part for him, an old English... I can't remember whether he was a shipwright or a dredger. I think he was a shipwright. The character was a shipwright called Cocker Freeman. Cocker was a... Oh, I forgot to mention that I'd written this book about Maldon in the meantime. And one of the characters in the Maldonians is called Cocker Bundock. Bundock being a very local name. Anyway, so we put together this play. Well, I wrote it and then he added a couple of things. And the main character was called Cocker Freeman. So by the time I was the play went down really well. It was it's a story of his life, 90 years, and how things had changed, not necessarily for the better, you know. He had his views, and it was funny as well. Anyway, so the character of Cocker Freeman had been born, and then in the mid 2000s, I suppose, hip hop was gaining ground. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if you had a well-known hip hop song sung by a 90-year-old Maldonian, you know? So I wrote this song and put it on top. I was recording in the houseboat. I had all that stuff there. I recorded this song to a well-known hit at the time called Soulja Boy, which I called Denji Boy. And it was also the time I was working, not getting paid, but I was working with my friend Nick Skeens, who owned a houseboat next door in Burnham. And he was running the Saint FM local radio, and determinedly wanted it to be local. So he liked the idea of Cocker Freeman, and Cocker Freeman used to come in one day a week and expound his views on local issues on his program. We had a program called the Purple Program, and so for that program I'd recorded this song, the Denji Boy song, with Cocker Freeman singing it. And Saint FM was it was located in a studio in what was then St. Peter's School in Burnham, and some of the kids in the school used to help out on the radio. One of them came in when this song was playing on the Purple Program. It was the Denji Boy song was playing on the Purple Program. The next day, the very next day, every kid in that school had Denji Boy on their phones. It was just phenomenal. And I had to make an appearance at their end of a year concert party thing. And they were screaming like mad. Anyway, Ray Clark, who was then breakfast presenter on BBC Essex, got me to interview me. He'd played Denji Boy, and he played a couple of the ones that I'd done after that. So I thought, oh, well, this is really, you know, quite exciting. People like this. So I did two or three of them. And they're all on YouTube now, still. And they have got combined something like 200,000 hits. And that must be mostly local, you know. Good one. I did one for the council elections in May, which I hadn't done it for about 8 years, but then I did one, which got a couple of thousand hits, I think. Anyway, it's very popular amongst certain councillors. Right, now, where was I? That's my local scene.
You mentioned a book, The Maldonians.
Yes.
What made you even think about writing The Maldonians, which was, I believe, set at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century?
Well, the book came about because I had the urge to build a model of a sailing barge. I'd done it several times. And flogged them. And I had this one, and I can't remember how it came about, but Essex Tourism, based in Chelmsford, they wanted to borrow my barge. They paid me to borrow it for their travel trade shows. I think I met them at it was one of the other things I did when I was in London, because I wasn't all the time I was in London. I had part-time jobs, and I was working for this travel marketing company and running this stand at Olympia. They had their World Travel Market, it was called. And I probably met Essex Tourism people there. Anyway, so I said, oh, I've got a model you might like. And they liked it, and they wanted me to put it on. They wanted to take it on the travel trade exhibitions. Anyway, they got asked a lot of questions about the barge. What did it do? When was its lifespan and all of that? So they asked me to write a little accompanying sheet of A4, introduction to a sailing barge. So I kind of started writing that, and then I got really interested in it, and actually it wasn't Essex that I was interested in, it was Malden. So, and I knew of John Howard, the barge builder, and Walter Cook, of course. Although Cook built 3 sailing barges. John Howard built 22, 23, can't remember exactly, and a few other things as well. So I was very disappointed to see the knitted thing, what do you call it?
The embroidery,
the Malden embroidery. And it's got Cook's on it. That's not right. It should be Howard, you know. Cook's barges were pretty much built for the job. You know, there were boxes. Howard's were beautiful yachts, almost barges. Depends on your point of view, I suppose, how much they held, what they did. So I got interested in that. So I wrote to somebody that I'd got to know about 1965 when my father got me to out on the sailing barge, the Memory, with John Kemp, and one of John Kemp's friends and a supporter of sailing barges, a great knowledge of sailing barges, was Harvey Benham, who wrote several books on Thames sailing barges. Down Topsail is quite a famous one. So I met him. I used to make good tea on the barge, so he let me stay. I was about 15 then. So I wrote to him as a more mature, 85, I was 35. Researcher and said, where will I find information about John Howard, you know, Malden barge builder? He said he'd never had time to find out about him a lot. He knew a few things, obviously. He knew what I was talking about. So he said, have you ever gone up to the National Newspaper Library at Colindale? It's part of the British Museum, British Library. So I said, no. He said, well, go up there. Ask if you can have a look. So ask if you can find out if there was a local newspaper in Malden at the time he was living and working. So I said, fantastic idea, thanks very much. It took me about a week to decipher his appalling handwriting. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I ended up at Colindale. And indeed, they let me in. I had a legitimate reason to be there. They did give you a pass, you know, to go and research stuff. I was, and there were several well-known people in there. I went in there on I can't remember what time of year it was, summer, I think. And I went in every Saturday for the next 6 months because I looked through the files and there was a local newspaper in Malden from 1872 till, 1916 was when I stopped reading it. And it was a fantastic thing. I was looking for John Howard initially, but I discovered this story, or at least the Victorian reporters just did everything verbatim, and it was all in the paper. It was fantastic. And you got to know all these characters. I mean, all the buildings were the same as they are now. Hmm. All the names are the same, pretty much, the surnames. And so I read through from the birth of the newspaper, 1872, until the First World War, basically. John Howard died in 1916. And from that, came the book. And it wasn't just about John Howard by any means. By that time, I'd got to know all these characters and what the subtitle is, Voices of Malden. And it's all of them talking from 1872 to 1916. Oh, and it was all the ructions about building a promenade and then building a lake, and some taxpayers were against it. When the day they opened the promenade, one of the solicitors, I think it was a solicitor in Silver Street, was described as keeping his curtains closed the whole day that this happened. Anyway, so in there, amongst other things, lots of other things, the big fire in Malden in 1892, the promenade opening, Edward Arthur Fitch and George and John Granger Sad, and a few other people, Bentall. They were all prominent people in getting the prom built. And there's lots of stories about that. And then at the lake opening in 1905, it all came in this period in the book about the Victorians. And the Victorians are pretty much exactly the same as the current Maldonian population. No real difference. Yes, there were a few scandals. All kinds of stuff. It's well worth a read. Yeah. Around about the mid-50s, my father was still at the Malden Secondary School. And he was assistant PE teacher to Mickey Mitchell, who'd been in the RAF, I think. Anyway, and they were kind of affiliated to the Labour Party, Labour Hall, where people like, now you got me for names, Dobson, Mr. Dobson, used to come round to Primrose Walk with a news, printed out newsletter and some kind of a bingo thing on it. And he came around every Saturday, dropped that off. So I got to know, the first thing that happened was I was in 5 or 6 at that point. So the people at Molly Brewster was another one at the Labour Hall, from Fitch's Crescent. She was a very eminent member of the Malden community, certainly Labour Party, and a husband as well. Anyway, my father sort of mixed with the Labour Party people, and they said they didn't have the numbers for the borough council elections coming up. Would he stand? And Mickey Mitchell was the same. He got asked to stand as well. It's just to make up the number so it looks okay on the thing. Anyway, so come the local elections. I don't know when it was. 55, something like that. Labour swept to power. Well, it didn't sweep to power, but most of the Labour candidates got in, including my dad and Mickey Mitchell. And so they were up there, walked up the spiral staircase to the council chamber in the Moot Hall, sat opposite, directly opposite the mayor. I don't know who was in the other Labour candidates or councillors at that time, included David Cargill, Dr. Cargill, who incidentally had been on the Jarrow March looking after the feet of the marchers. He might have been in a car or something, I don't know. But he was there at the Jarrow March looking after the feet of the marchers. Anyway, so, and he was a Labour mayor of Malden, one of the very few. So he was part of that. Mostly the old crew who I can't really remember. Edwards, of Edwards Walk, He was an alderman, I think. So I knew, you know, mayor, alderman, councillors. My father was a councillor. And he was on the River and Pleasure Grounds Committee. So come carnival time, all I remember is we got in everything free. We were allowed in. I was allowed in anyway. He was a councillor. So come the fireworks down the lake, we were in the the director's box, as it were. My dad was there. And they generally looked after, amongst other things, they were in charge of the lake and the promenade. So later in life, when I was about 15, I think, my dad knew everyone on the prom, Mr. Harmon, who was the lake keeper, and I never remember his name, the white-haired chap that was the prom keeper. Anyway, my dad introduced me to them, and I got a job running the paddle boats. It must have been about 65. Can't remember much about it now. But I was running the paddle boats only for, the summer. And before that, I'd actually worked unpaid for Mr. Harmon, because it was quite prestigious to be inside the changing block, hanging up the baskets and giving out the rubber rings with the number on, that kind of thing. I loved doing that. I used to do that and go swimming, obviously. I can't remember. I used to run the... I used to be the parking attendant. As you go into the prom, next to the bowling club was the little hut where the chap stood that took the tickets or sold the tickets for parking on the prom. So I did that as well. I think I got about £5 an hour for that. Anyway, so yes, I was fully employed on the prom for a while. And then I forgot about it all in the midst of everything else. When we came to the early 2000s, when suddenly this horrific news that they were going to close the lake had everyone astir. It was a shock. It was a shock for everyone that the council, it was then a Maldon District Council, not the Borough Council, had decided to close the lake. There had been this incident, this fatal incident, where a man had dived in and hit his head on a submerged post. Actually, the submerged post was a stanchion that originally held a sign, a wooden sign, above the water saying, "Do not dive," something like that. Maldon District Council were liable for it, cost a lot of money, court case. And then they said they thought it was too much trouble to maintain the lake, possibly too expensive as far as they were concerned. And so they decided to close it. Now, this was horrific for most of the people that had grown up in Maldon. This was an absolutely unbelievable decision to have made. It was a jewel in Maldon's crown. People that I've met, many people used to come on buses from all over the county to come to Maldon, because it's the one spot in Essex, certainly, that had this kind of facility. I mean, I know they've got a pond or a tidal pond at Tollesbury or various other things, but nothing like the Marine Lake. There was nothing like it. And we spent all our youths down there. So they decided to close it. And in 2000, and whenever it was, 3, 4, they did. And I was so incensed that my way of responding to that, pretty futile really, but I wrote a play. And it was a one-man play. It was basically the Cocker Freeman character talking in about his 90 years again, but mostly talking about the lake. And it was put it on at the town hall on the night of the 100th anniversary of the opening of the lake, 2005, June the 26th, I think it was. And packed out. I did it at least once more, possibly twice, I can't remember, to packed out houses. And everybody was in agreement. I did radio interviews and stuff like that. Didn't mean a thing. Didn't mean a thing. And recently, along that same vein of a lot of people, you know, the whole childhoods have been connected with the lake. You know, it was a hugely important part of their lives. Recently, there has been a movement campaign to reinstate the lake for swimming. And I've done a few things for them. Written magazine articles, that kind of thing. And they've got, as far as I'm aware, I'm not sure. They've got 8,000 signatures on their petition, and I think that's just online, which means I know they've been trying to get people to sign the petition in the flesh as well. So that would mean something like 11,000. I'm not sure about those figures. But certainly they've got 8,000 signatures from people. Just over the majority of them are from the Maldon district. But others are people that travel into Maldon, visitors that remember the lake. And I think of my father and the days of the River and Pleasure Grounds committee that he was on, turning in his grave. As I say, I did write in the Maldonians. There is a theme going through it about them coming to the conclusion that a marine lake would be a wonderful thing once they got permission to buy it off Ben Handley, who lived on the Bath Wall. He lived on the Bath Wall, was the Bath Wall proprietor. All the new houses off the bypass, the new ones, it's all called Handley Gardens. That's Handley. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Handleys in Maldon. So anyway, he was holding out for more money for years, because they would have done it at the same time as the prom. But anyway, he held out another 10 years until he retired, and then he sold the creek basically. And so they knocked down the wall between the creek and the Bath Wall, and turned it into the lake. And it was what really strikes me, and is evident in the book, is that there were people in Maldon in positions of authority, i.e. the town council, as it was then in the 1890s. Edward Arthur Fitch, John Granger Sadd, Bentall, loads more. And they had the vision. They had the vision to see what this muddy little market garden could become, you know. And they did it, and they pushed it through despite other ratepayers not being interested and absolutely against it, saying it's too far from the town, it will never work, you know. This was about the time when the Maldon had got round to building a sewer system. They didn't have one before. I explain this at the very first paragraph of the book. A system of sewerage is a symbol of a town's sophistication, you know. The fact that Moulton didn't have one didn't seem to matter to the residents entirely. They lived on a hill for one thing, and there was a river at the bottom of it. No problem. Anyway, so it took them about 40 years to fall in with government strictures that they should have as a system of sewerage. So they built the system of sewerage, which was originally where the old dump was, down there. And some people complained that if they built a promenade and or a lake at that end of the town, it would stink from the sewage works, you know. And so the people who were against the lake got a Heybridge Basin fisherman to come and speak at the tribunal or whatever it was, the public inquiry. And he said, yeah, well, you know, if you have the lake there, I mean, I can smell the Moulton sewage from Heybridge Basin. So the solicitor representing the people who wanted the lake said, well, don't you know that was there's an outflow from Heybridge at the basin? And he said, no, this is Moulton sewage, I smell. Anyway, they had the vision. They had the vision to build this promenade. The promenade was, I mean, and recreation grounds were a big Victorian thing. Every town was building a recreation ground because it's to do with health and vitality, and this is what the Victorians were about, which is true, absolutely true. But Moulton did it, but Moulton had this lake as well, and it was unique. The jewel in the crown, as they called it, and that this current Moulton District Council, and going back, same people are on it now that were on it when the decision was made to close it, haven't got that vision. They haven't got the imagination, and most of all, I don't think any of them actually swam in that lake as kids. They've got no idea what they're talking about in any direction, to be honest. Particularly one of the councillors was interviewed on BBC Essex, and he talked a lot of rot that was factually incorrect in support of not opening the lake up. He certainly had never, ever been in that lake, you know. There's a lot of good lines in the play I wrote about it. For instance, you know, they're saying, you know, people weeing in the lake and that kind of thing. And I said, well, any kid had one mouthful of that lake and you were inoculated for life. It was in terms of health and safety, blah, blah, blah. Yes, that's the lake.